forgot to remind you that Leah will also do blood pressure screenings in the library after church. And she needs to do that because she's really not contributing very much otherwise. She's trying to get people involved. So that reading, Jonah is in a way a story about jealousy. Jonah did not like the Ninevites, and he didn't want to go there and preach that God loved them because he was afraid they would repent and God would be good to them. It was about jealousy. And so now in that light, listen to our story today from Matthew 20. The kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into the vineyard. About 9 in the morning, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, "You also go and work in my vineyard, and I'll pay you whatever's right." So they went. He went out again about noon and about 3 in the afternoon and then did the same thing. About 5 in the afternoon, he went out and found still others standing around. He asked them, "Why have you been standing here all day doing nothing?" "No one's hired us," they answered. He said to them, "You also go and work in my vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his supervisor, "Call all the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones we hired and going on to the first." The workers who were hired about 5 in the afternoon came and each received a denarius. So when those came who were hired first, they expected to receive more. But each one of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. "These men who were hired last, they only worked 1 hour," they said. "And you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day." But he answered one of them, "Friend, I'm not being unfair to you. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Now take your pay and go. I want to give the one who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious? Are you envious? Because I'm generous. So the last will be first, and the first will be last." Here ends the reading. Comparing ourselves to other people is a hard habit to break once you start doing it. I could give you dozens of examples of how I struggle with envy, but for the sake of time and my own dignity, I'm just going to let one story suffice. In high school, I was good at math. But I wanted to be good at something else. I wanted to be good at something that was more fun, more promising. Most of my math teachers, they did seem to enjoy their work, but the prospect of teaching math, that was not interesting to me. So here I had something that I was pretty good at, but I literally could not imagine how I could ever make a career out of math. Now, I know that you in accounting and you bankers are thinking, "You're an idiot." Fine, but just stick with me, all right? I planned in high school to become either a physician or a pastor. Those were my two career paths. Because I'm drawn to status and wealth, I wound up choosing to become a pastor. When I took college entrance exams, my math scores were quite high. My verbal scores were utterly average. Now, this worried me a bit and gave me pause because I would need to write and to speak quite a bit in my work as a pastor. But I figured, hey, math isn't going to get me anywhere in life, so I charged ahead. Several years later, I decided I wanted to go to graduate school, and I needed to take this thing called the GRE, the standard test for attending graduate schools in any field of the humanities. I had not taken a math course in 5 years, mind you, and still, my math scores were way better than my verbal reasoning scores. At the end of my master's degree, I needed to take the GRE again to get my scores up because I wanted to apply for PhD programs. At this point, it had been 8 years since I had taken a math course, and again, my math scores were way higher than my verbal reasoning scores. One of my advisors, a woman completely on my side, this is the woman who got me into my doctoral program, she called me in and she said, I think you should take your GRE again. She said, your math scores are very impressive, but we're not doing math here. You need to get your score up in these verbal reasoning sections. Now, flash forward a little bit to when we were living in New York City. I was serving a congregation there. There's a wonderful couple in our congregation, and both of them worked in finance. They were from Texas. They had met at the University of Texas in Austin. Both of them went to MIT after that. They were involved in flash trading, which I barely understand. That is, they wrote software that can trade in and out of positions in the stock market in millionths of a second. They are generous people, delightful people, very committed to the church. Just, they're wonderful people. It was an absolutely amazing apartment, penthouse. So on the Wednesday of Thanksgiving week, they would invite lots of us over to their penthouse apartment because it overlooked the Natural Science Museum, which is where they inflate all the balloons for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. That was always a wonderful time. Since then, they have moved back to Austin, Texas, where they outbid Matthew McConaughey for a piece of lakefront property where they built a beautiful home. Stephanie and her friends visited them recently, and they were there for a day, and then they were leaving town, but they told Stephanie to feel free to drive one of the two Teslas in the garage. I remember when I was first getting to know these people, I asked them, you know, how did they decide to go to MIT in the first place and get into finance? And they kind of looked at each other and shrugged their shoulders and said, I don't know, we're just kind of good at math. Now, let me be clear. My point is not that I could have followed their path. They are twice as smart as I am. My point is simply that it's hard to meet other people in life and not get into this game of comparisons. And it's funny how all this comparing works, isn't it really? I mean, when I think about it, I actually like what I do. And my house, I mean, this house we rent, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. I feel pretty good about my 14-year-old car. It has 130,000 miles on it, but it's got leather seats. And to me, that's really cool. I love leather seats. I feel good about that. But once you start comparing your life and your situation to other people, it's easy to become negative or bitter or competitive or envious, to wish you had some life other than the one you have. The story that Jesus tells about the generous vineyard owner and the grumbling workers can help us, I think, move past this game where we compare ourselves to other people. But first, just a quick word about the literary context in Matthew's gospel so we can catch what's going on. Now, if you look back earlier in chapter 19, in the paragraphs right before this parable, the disciples criticize people for bringing their children to Jesus. They're like, God, he is too busy and your children don't matter. And what does Jesus say? Jesus says, no, you bring them. Bring all these kids to me. The kingdom of God belongs to kids like these. Whoa. Just a little bit after that, the disciples sort of grumble to Jesus and say, you know, we've abandoned a lot. We left our jobs and our families and we lost income streams so that we could follow you. I mean, are we going to be okay? Like, is there, you know, or any rewards for us or anything? And Jesus said, guys, settle down. It's going to be okay. He said, you'll get what's coming to you, not just you, but anyone at all who leaves houses or family or income streams or assets or opportunities so that they can follow me. They'll get 100-fold in this life and in the life to come, eternity. And the last thing Jesus says is, keep in mind, guys, those who look like they're losing are winning. Not long after the parable, the mother of James and John, this is a bold woman, she comes to Jesus sort of, you know, in secret and says, hey, I know all 12 of your apostles, I mean, they're all talented one way or another, but my sons, James and John, they're pretty sharp. I don't know if you've gotten to know them well, but probably they should have the two highest cabinet positions in your reign. And that leads to an argument among the disciples about who's the greatest. And Jesus, at that point, says, aiming at greatness will always make a disaster of your life. importance and rank and status in this new kingdom, in this new way of life, always goes to those people who humble themselves so that they can serve others. Okay? So this is the stuff around the parable. Status, wealth, who matters, importance, rank, what's greatness mean? And then this parable. So come back to the parable. Jesus wants to help us understand what it's like to live in this new way, what it's like to live in God's kingdom. And this new and surprising life calls for new behavior from all of us. The God who invites you and me to work in the vineyard will also be inviting many other people to work as well. So don't waste any time comparing your workday to theirs. Don't get caught up in nets of envy or jealousy or comparing how hard your day was to theirs. Just a few interesting features of this weird little story that Jesus tells. First, we notice that the workers are sent into the vineyard at all different points during the day in different stages. So the earliest crew, like Leah told the kids, would have worked from sunup to sundown, right? And then there were other crews that came throughout the day. And the last crew that were hired worked barely an hour before the bell rang and the day was over. Okay, so that's odd. Next, we notice that the wages agreed upon for the first group was very clear. The landowner promised them a denarius. It wasn't a great wage. It was pretty low. But that was basically what a poor laborer made for a day. That was the usual daily wage. But for those who were hired in different staggered sets through the rest of the day, the pay scale gets a little bit ambiguous. Did you notice that? To the next couple of groups, the landowner just says, go to work in the vineyard and I'll pay you what's right. What does that mean, right? So what do they expect? And then doesn't say anything to the last group. But we assume that they will be paid in proportion to the length of the day that they work, right? Equal pay for equal work. Third, we notice that this landowner, I mean, who is this guy? He has an unusual way of hiring help for the vineyard. He seems to be out in the marketplace, out in the public square all day long, just seeing who's standing around, available to go to work. He's out hiring at sunup, hires some more at 9 in the morning, at noon, at 3 p.m., and this landowner's still out there in the marketplace at 5 in the afternoon hiring people. What on earth is this guy doing? Why such a hiring spree? I mean, maybe it's time to reap the grapes. I don't know. The story doesn't tell us that. Maybe he needs lots of labor. But the detail that's mentioned not once but twice in the story, in verse 3 and verse 6, is that the landowner is bothered that people are standing around idle, and that's the word in some translations, or doing nothing. That's the NIV. And the landowner seems particularly troubled by people who are just wasting time when there's good work to be done. Yesterday, I was in Salina for the Prairie Festival at this place called the Land Institute. It was my second time to be there. It's a celebration of farming and food. That doesn't sound that interesting, but it is a fascinating festival. Lots of interesting people. The crowd is made up of farmers, environmentalists, college students, college teachers, scientists, chefs, a bunch of other people like me. I don't know why they're there. The panel at the Prairie Festival yesterday morning was led by this woman who's in charge of this place called the Stone Barns at Blue Hill Center for Food and Agriculture. Now, I was interested in hearing her and her panel because Blue Hill is a restaurant 20 miles north of New York City. We have eaten there once. It is, in my estimation, the best restaurant in New York. It is the best meal I've ever eaten in my life. I think we've paid off that credit card bill. I'm not sure. I don't think I'm just saying this. We went to two other couples. One of the other couples was from Colombia. The woman had been trained at culinary school. She was a chef, and she was blown away by the meal and blown away by the wine. It was an amazing experience. And this restaurant is located on a farm, that produces the food that you eat. It's all about local stuff grown right there. And a sort of fancy food research institute all rolled into one. One of the primary goals of this research center is to raise up a new generation of farmers. That's exciting to me. And two different panelists yesterday morning made the point of talking about how farming is such difficult work and that it's still amazing that so many young people want to learn how to farm. It's sort of a renewed thing. They're seeing more and more high school students who want to start farming. Maybe it's a family farm and they want to take a mentorship or an apprenticeship with an established farmer. Lots of college graduates are ditching their degrees, whatever they study, because they want to farm. They want to get their hands dirty. They want to grow food. They want to be involved in restaurants and food and farming. But what they said was that lots of high school kids and college kids who apply for these internships on various farms, they often have no idea what work really means, especially work on a farm. Some of them can't hack it. They can't do it. One guy gave an example. He's like, I always ask first question, how many of you have changed a tire? He's like, almost no young person has ever changed a tire. He's like, well, we got work to do. So we back up and we start with that. So some don't want to do the work and they quit, but others of them absolutely fall in love with the work of farming the land and raising food. They love the effort, the sweat, and the toil of taking care of the land, of plants and animals. They get up at 6 a.m. They finish their day at 7. They go to bed absolutely exhausted but utterly happy. Lots of stories of this. The vineyard owner is inviting people to work. To work. Because work is good and work is satisfying and work is enjoyable. And being productive and making a difference and being tired at the end of the day is something that's incredibly good for all of us. That's why the vineyard owner is inviting people to work. God invites us into this strange new kind of life with other people, and it's a lot like farm work. It's hard. And yet, if anybody told you this was about something different, about going to church or obeying some rules or believing something, they sold you a bill of goods. This is about becoming friends with God, friends with other people who are friends with God, and doing good work together. Now, finally, the thing I want you to notice about this odd little story is that there's something extremely unusual about the way that all the workers were organized at the time to be paid. So the owner instructs his manager to be sure and pay them in reverse order in which they were hired. So those hired at 5 p.m., they were queued up first, they were to be paid first, and then those at 3, those at noon, on down to those who were hired at sunup. And this seems odd already, but the story gets even more unusual when those who showed up at 5 were handed, for only an hour's worth of work, they were handed a full day's wage. So those later in the line, especially those who'd worked all day, thought they had hit the jackpot. If these guys got a full day's wage for only an hour of work, just imagine what we're going to get for working in the sun, toiling all day long. But then each of them gets paid the same daily rate, even those who've been working all day. Now, if this parable was hard, confusing, difficult for the crowds in Jesus' day to hear, it will be doubly so for us because we love inequality. We love it almost like nothing else. We love inequality. We cannot imagine a world in which a plumber or a child care worker makes the same amount as an entertainer or a physician or a business owner. We sit on our hands as the most powerful industries in the world lobby government for special perks for themselves, while our pitiful little votes mean next to nothing. We cheer exuberantly for an economy in which the average CEO makes 400 times what the average worker makes. We love inequality. We like the way it sorts us all out and assigns us our own value, our place in the chain, our rank. And it makes it almost impossible for us to hear the good news in this parable about a new way of life, about God's generosity and how God's grace levels the field and calls for the equal dignity of all people everywhere. Did you notice their complaint to the landowner? Verse 12. But you made them equal to us. See the complaint? But you made them equal to us. Equal. And to their complaint, the landowner simply replies, "Are you envious because I leveled the playing field? Are you envious because I'm generous?" The old life that all of us are used to is unequal in a thousand ways, yet it somehow comforts all of us to know where we stand, know our place. Few people above us, few people below us, but at least we know where we are. We know where we rank. We're a little afraid of walking into this new life where absolutely everyone is equal. We're not even sure we're ready for this good news. If it sounds like what the Apostle Paul describes as a life where there's no male or female, no slave or free, no this or that, no married or unmarried, no straight or gay, no this or that kind of religion, no black, brown, or white, no employer, employee, no able, disabled, no immigrant, citizen, no nothing. Everybody is loved by God in Jesus Christ. Boy, that's a tough way to live. How can we hear this parable in a world where many are calling for new boundaries, new measurements, new ways of dividing and comparing? With this global economy and international trade and open borders, work is becoming more and more complex, and so some are afraid and are shouting America first. With women graduating from college in much greater numbers than men and taking on leadership roles across the economy, many men are now shouting, "Women should stay at home and take care of their children." With racial diversity increasing, leaving only a couple of decades before whites become a minority group in the U.S., many are shouting, "Let's go back to the good old days. Let's turn back the clock to when whites decided how things will go for everyone else." Now, what would happen if we were to welcome this new way of life, this announcement of good news, that everyone is equal before God's generosity? Well, maybe we could stop comparing our lives, what our lives feel like now, to some other time in our life when we liked ourselves better. Have you ever done that? Maybe we could stop comparing our lives to the situations of other people. Maybe we could stop comparing our family to other families where it looks like everything's going great. It's not, by the way, but that's what we think, right? Maybe we could stop comparing our jobs to other people's jobs. Maybe we could stop comparing our congregation to other congregations. Maybe we could stop comparing our humble little community to other places that seem to be thriving in ways we're not. The good news of God's love means that you and I can be freed from this terrible burden of comparing ourselves with others. Freed from the prison of jealousy and envy, we can receive our own lives and our own roles in God's vineyard with gladness, and we can let go of our long list of complaints and grievances. We can finally let go of all of our arguments for competition and inequality in the rankings of winners and losers. We can welcome a new life in which we are amazingly loved, and so is everyone else. Amen. For our response hymn this morning, we'll sing page 466 in your hymnals, "Take My Life and Let It Be." And as we sing this, if you found yourself struggling with some comparisons that you keep going back to, maybe you can let this song be a prayer and sort of offer that up and say, "This isn't working for me. I want to be done with this."